Recorder on? Alrighty, this is the Joint Interim Task Force on Mega Transportation Projects. It's November 1st, 2018, and we're ready to go. Patrick? Welcome, everybody.
Oh, yeah, thanks, Mr. Chair. Today, we're going to have some presentation on case studies, mega projects then and now from Paul Mather. Still hanging
You're
out.
You're on, Paul.
Department of Transportation.
All right.
This is a demonstration that you really never can retire.
Oh my gosh, he's even got the box.
Okay. Good morning, Paul Mander. I'm Highway Division, ODOT. This has been a fun project to work on. You sent me off on an assignment when I was here last to do some case studies on, so why back in the day we get things done and today it seems so hard and difficult to get things done. Why? So why is that? And it's been interesting for me and being with ODOT for 35 years and knowing bits and pieces of stories of different projects to go back and kind of complete the stories and really understand why things happened the way they did. And I actually found some pretty interesting things I think you'll enjoy. And as I give more introduction, I wanted to show you this video that I found, just to give you some context. When we're talking about then versus now, this is a video from then. So you see some of the construction techniques that we have. You'll see some vehicles come up in here, and just the state of our highway, and just the way we did our work back then. And you see in here just how different it is today, just the world we live in, than it was back then. This was highway beautification, was planting a couple of flowers. You may recognize that just south of Salem, Southern Oregon I-5. Just even our equipment, some equipment in here. Not much traffic on I-5. able to just go and do our road work without a whole lot of conflict. There's a log truck, a little different than today's trucking. You'll see a couple other trucks come by here that are quite a bit different. So anyway, this is just a short video I thought I'd just share with you to give you some sense of how different the world is as I talk about some of our processes. And
about what year is that, Paul?
You know, it's a compilation of different videos. I would say it's between 50 and 60 years ago. Most of these early 60s, maybe late 50s is when most of these were taken.
Gosh.
Okay. So last time I was here, I outlined just quickly some of the key timelines of some of the major legislation or major events that shaped this conversation. And I just highlighted a few here. Actually, in 1947, the legislature authorized ODOT, or then the Highway Department, to build controlled access roads. We are actually ahead of the Interstate Act that passed in 56, and we're building interstate-looking highways. In fact, Salem to Portland was built before the Interstate Act was passed. In 1966, they passed a Department of Transportation Act, and Section 4F of that was turned out to be, and we still use it a lot today, a very significant piece of legislation that forces us or asks us to look at the impact to parks, wildlife refuge, and historic sites and make sure that we don't have any feasible or reasonable way to avoid those impacts. And when we do impact, we have to minimize. So a lot of times you'll hear us talking when we're designing projects, we have to miss those parks, we have to miss golf courses, we have to miss those things. And we keep talking about 4F, at least as we're developing projects, and it comes back to this act that passed in 1966 and was really the first piece of legislation that started to limit minimize those impacts to certain types of properties. Also in 66, the Highway Safety Act, so it provided uniform standards across the country, passed. This was the first time, or not the very first time, but this really codified the need for national standards for safety, whether it's guardrail, lane widths, shoulders, those types of things. It set in practice those safety standards that we use today and continue to evolve and change. The big landmark legislation was then 1969, the NEPA, which had several impacts, and I'll show you the impacts of that as on several projects. Happened in 69, ODOT was formed. Clean Air Act passed in 70 from air quality and attainment status. We still today talk about that and meeting air quality standards in our different areas that have air quality issues. And then Senate Bill 100 in 1973 was another significant piece of legislation passed that had significant impacts on how we develop, design, and get our project approvals. So those are just the ones I pulled out. There's other ones, the Clean Water Act. There's others that came after this, but these were the kind of the major milestones that I saw during that kind of shift in how we build our projects and what it takes to get those projects completed. So in between here, I just thought I'd give you a timeline of the projects I'm going to talk about. So in 1955, I-5 between Salem-Portland was completed. That was as a result of that legislation in 47, was a state-funded effort. I-5 between Salem and Portland was rebuilt in the middle 70s. You may have remembered that when we expanded it to three lanes. That was built with interstate money, but the first time we built it was actually with state funds. The Interstate Act passed.
Paul, I'm curious about that, as I remember driving to Portland in 67 and the Twilliger curves and all of that. You didn't go in that way. You went in on what's Barber Boulevard.
Right. I'll show you
completed.
Yeah, I'll show you an example of when we built that. So when I talk about Portland to Salem, that's probably more roughly Tiger to Salem is probably a more accurate representation, because you went in on Barber Boulevard in that, so we built that section. And I got an example that shows you when that was built. And
right there about that, the 217 interchange, just slightly north of the 217 interchange, is my recollection, is where it began to be controlled access from there south.
Yeah, it was right in there. I'm going to talk about South Medford Interchange. It was completed in 63 after the Interstate Act. I-5 was completed, and I kind of maybe use quotes around completed because it was a combination of the state-funded as well as the Interstate Act in 66. Interesting enough, the total cost of I-5 was about $300 million to build all of I-5.
Wow.
Today, if we were going to widen three lanes from Salem to Eugene, it would cost us about $1.5 billion. So to give you some sense of scale. Backing up to the Interstate Act, that 90-10 is on there. That's the funding split. So the feds paid 90 cents on the dollar for every dollar. As I'll talk about here in a minute, that has flipped almost completely now, where it's about 90-10 the other direction. I-405 was completed in 69. We got in kind of under the wire for NEPA, as well as the first half of I-205. And it's a pretty interesting case study on 205. Mm-hmm. The south half of 205 was built before NEPA, and the north half had to go through the NEPA process. And thus, you'll see the completion of I-205 took until 83 before it was completed, because you went through that NEPA process. So here's some of I've touched on some of these already, but just the design standards have gone up significantly during this time period. It's not just the standards, but the features that we build routinely with our projects. Back in the day, we were not worried about bike paths, water detention facilities, transit pullouts, those types of things. Those features are routinely part of our projects. And then just the ever-changing standards that we see. One of the frustrations that I have kind of personally is the amount of times the national standards for guardrail get changed. They get changed, it seems like, every 5 to 10 years. And so anytime we touch a piece of pavement, we've got to go upgrade the guardrail. And so we're always upgrading that guardrail to the newest standards and the cost that it takes to that. And if you look at some of our really old highways that we don't spend a lot of time on, I think maybe like the Coos River Highway or the Powers Highway, that guardrail's been there for 50, 60 years, and we haven't touched it. And it is like 10 versions of standards back from where it was. So we keep investing money more and more into guardrail that's a little bit better, and the guardrail that's really bad stays out there.
Who's making those changes?
Happens at the federal, the federal level.
Federal
Highway Administration.
Okay.
They set those standards. And we're on national committees, and we raised the point I just made, and it's quite a debate back and forth as to how you implement those standards. How would you phase those in? Liability plays a big factor in that. And if you know you have, a safer guardrail, why aren't you putting those in there when you have, a crash in that area?
Mm-hmm. So it's often driven by some event that says, okay, now if we'd only done it a little bit better, we could have avoided a death at that event.
Yes, and there's also research that continues to happen in finding safer ways. Our facilities have pulled out guardrail, but there's research for rumble strips and other things that have been that we've implemented based on research.
I have a quick question about the guardrails. When you have to replace something or something happens, do you have to go, like, every time you have to update it to the new standard? And there's not like a thing where, if it's within three standards, we don't have to touch it. It's always to the best.
Yes, that's the typical way we do things. When we touch a piece of roadway or do a project, mm-hmm. we have to bring that entire section of highway up to the current standard. Sometimes we can get what's called design exceptions, mm-hmm. But we have to do a good documentation of that and be able to basically withstand in a legal proceeding if someone were to crash an area, why we made the decision we did not to bring a piece up to standard or some fell short of the standard in whatever way, to make sure we document why we made the curve a little sharper or why the roadway is a little narrower than what the design standards would say.
Okay.
Just our NEPA and planning documentation has gone up significantly, and I'll have a demonstration here in a little bit about just how much that has changed. The cost to a project, just going through that project, is about 10% of the cost of the project is roughly what it takes just to go through that planning NEPA stage. You haven't got into design, you haven't bought right away, but just that cost alone. At a minimum, the NEPA process can take 2 to 3 years, and there's examples of 2 or 3 decades going through that process. Material construction costs have gone up. They've doubled since about 2000. I didn't go back further than that, but just I think we've all seen.
Can I stop? I'm on the NEPA process, 2 years to 2 decades. Is the length of that more dependent on public challenge or questions being raised, or just the technical studies that have to be done?
I would say yes. The other factor in there.
Yes, which?
Yes.
It depends on the project. But one of the other big factors is there's not funding. I'm going to talk about Newburgh-Dundee here in a minute. And it went through, 2 or 3 decades of the planning process. But part of what drove that was there wasn't an identified funding source for that. And so there wasn't an urgency or a driver to get through to a decision because you didn't have funding secured. Examples where we have funding secured and we're trying to finish the environmental document up, we're more in that 2 or 3 year time frame that we can get things done. If there's not funding beyond the environmental phase or the planning phase of a project, there's not the urgency to get things moving through the process. So that's another big factor in the timelines.
Question. So in the NEPA process, if it takes too long and, like you said, doesn't have the funding, does it then become irrelevant in 5 years when things change?
Yes.
So then you have to start back all over again?
Typically, we don't have to start back all over again, but we do have to update our information, update our different reports that we've done for that. So there's a shelf life to it. As you examine and do your studies and projections, there's a shelf life to that. And depends on the circumstances of what has changed and how you can document it. It hasn't changed or has changed, you got to update that.
Can you use the example of the bridge? Mm-hmm. That one's how old as far as that report?
I don't remember the exact date. It's about 4 or 5 years old in that neighborhood.
2012?
Well, from the beginning to end.
My memory is
that. If we were to pick that up again, we'd have to update the different pieces. Now, if you change the design significantly, then you've got to go back to the start over again. Yeah. So that's assuming you're staying roughly with the same design approach to the project, and you're just updating the various factors that go into that. If you change the project significantly, then you're talking about changing the process significantly too.
That suggestion, I remember when we were talking about the bridge, that you really makes sense. You really shouldn't start the environmental until you have an agreement on a design.
Yeah. And the other learning that I have is you also need to have some pathway of funding, because you can sit in kind of a never land of a loop you're going through and over again. If you don't have the urgency to complete that environmental phase or the planning phase to get the project funded, you ought to have at least a pathway for funding. You may not have it completely identified, but you've got commitments and you've got some ideas on how you're going to get the project funded.
We're kind of getting you off the track, but this is confusing me a little bit, because it's sort of a chicken and egg problem.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know what your design is, then how much funding you need isn't clear. If you don't know what your design is, the environmental impacts aren't clear. I mean, it really feels like you've got to do it in a cohesive way, or you're.
And as a designer, we're trying to stay within some budget. So without any given parameters, you could be designing something that's like this, and we hand it over to someone to figure out the funding, and you've got this huge project, and then you're back into phase. Mm-hmm. You give some parameters to, hey, the budget is, you know, about this or that. To stay within, it starts to put some parameters to your design and your environmental process and the resources that you would have as part of that project. So it is. It's a chicken and egg. It's an iterative process, and I think that's one of the learnings that I had through this process. Is the more you can make that an iterative process or a conversation back and forth between the funding policy side versus those working on the projects and the specifics of the impacts of those projects, the more successful you'll be in accelerating the timeline of the project and keeping the project's footprint into what you really want or can afford for a project.
So it sounds like it's important to start really on to scope the project. And include, when I say that, I mean, here's what we want to build, and here's how much money it's going to cost, and get an agreement generally on that up front so that you're working within a broad parameter before you start getting down to doing NEPA work or design work.
Right.
The experience that I've had in the last 2 years with QBS, qualified-based decision-making between, you know, all the public entities, like the school districts and the water districts and the fire districts, and then, you know, trying to get the designers, you know, on board so that both sides of the conversation felt like they could do exactly what you just said. And that is have an integrated process talking about what the project would be, what the design would be, you know, what were some of the options and the creativity that you wanted to look at. And then also make sure that the designers knew what the budget, you know, at least have a scope of the budget. You have to scope the design and scope the budget at the same time, because both sides of the conversation have got to have that information.
Right.
And I think the bridge in the 2009 and 2011 sequence there is really good for us to study what we did last time. Yes. Because I think right now, I mean, I'm hoping for a positive forward movement on that other committee that we're meeting on next Wednesday. And to do that, we've got to learn the lessons from last time and figure out what it is that we can do better this time. And to me, it's that conversation has got to be working on both sides.
Correct.
Question. As far as the NEPA process goes, I guess I don't know exactly how much power they have. And so could you do everything you guys are talking about and then incorporate NEPA at the, you know, more in the later stages, and they say, no, this isn't going to work at all? So do you have the potential of getting all the way to that process and then bringing NEPA in and them saying, nah, no?
I think that's
So the risk that you're running, is you're developing the project and you're going through NEPA, the appeal process through either a lawsuit or appealing it to federal court is really what you're working against. You've got different decision-making bodies that will make decisions. And I'll talk here a little bit about land use and the example of Newburgh Dundee, where the driving force ended up being more around the land use decisions that the four jurisdictions need to make that really kept the conversation kind of in the state venue rather than the federal venue. If you did away with Senate Bill 100 and you didn't have the land use issues, you would have just dealt with the same issues in a federal venue with NEPA rather than in a state venue with the land use planning issues.
Okay.
Okay. So federal funding, I've touched on this already, has gone down. One of the effects of that is now almost all of our major projects have more significant state funds than federal funds on them. One of the other things that has happened is the shift of state versus local funding of the gas tax. Back in the day, it was a 70-30 split where the state got 70%, 30 for local. But as that federal funds went away and the locals needed more funding to fill that, that has shifted to a 50-50% split, which has put more pressure on the state side of things. Unified public support is on any issue, whether it's transportation or anything, is a challenge, it seems like, nowadays. So that has gone down. The public involvement that we do compared to back in the day, it's hard to even draw a comparison. I mean, our public involvement back in the day was going out, holding a meeting, and telling people what we were going to do. It was one meeting with, here's where the road's going to be. Where today, it's a much more interactive process. We have area commissions on transportation, and we do an extensive amount of public involvement. But at the same time, we've seen the number of lawsuits go up on our projects, whether, again, that's in the state venue with the land use process or on the federal side with NEPA. So this is, I thought, an interesting photograph that kind of illustrates. So why do we have NEPA, you know, to begin with? If we just did away with NEPA, our projects would be just a whole lot easier to do. This is a picture where the Memorial Coliseum sits today. That ramp's coming off there are from the steel bridge. Just in, my cursor will work, right? In here is where I-5 sits today. So this is pre-I-5. Just in that footprint for the Memorial Coliseum, there was almost 500 houses that were taken out for that. So you think about,
couldn't do that today.
Here's a picture when the Coliseum was completed, and we're starting to build I-5 in here today where it is. Down here you'll see the ramps coming from I-84 through here. I don't have a number, but just imagine the amount of houses and inputs it had to the Albina neighborhood. The Albina neighborhood was a thriving African-American neighborhood back in the day, and the impacts that the combination of the freeway, the Memorial Coliseum, and the hospital impacts still live with today. And as we design, here I'll just show you a couple more pictures. Here's from 1962. We're still working on the freeway. You can just see the Memorial Coliseum just off on the side here.
Paul?
And that's what it looked like when we completed it.
Have you come across any evidence that the alignment of I-5 had any kind of racial or socioeconomic overtone to it in terms of how that got established?
Yeah, I think we see that nationally. As engineers and planners were trying to build the highway in the cheapest, most economic way and go into areas of our community where the land values are less, and we're going to have less opposition to our designs. I think it was naturally that we were gravitated to those areas. So I think that's and why we have NEPA and why we have a lot of other laws and processes today that we've got to go through to balance out that conversation. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think there's evidence, I think, in Oregon as well as nationally where that was done.
I think we have to be careful on that. It's the impact was it had a racial impact. The intent was you went to the cheapest land.
Right.
It just happened to be that particular neighborhood.
And lacking any kind of policy direction or anything else from other places, that's what we're going to gravitate to is trying to build the cheapest, most efficient transportation system.
And couldn't do that today.
Right. Exactly. Well, we have other things, policies that guide us differently than what we had back then. Yeah, I don't think there was any intent to do that, but that's where we were guided. So here's just a picture of Rose Quarter, what we envision it to look like, and why, when we talk about the lid,
that's
why
stark.
That's such an important issue of trying to stitch that community back together again, is we're out there designing that project Those three projects that I talked about, I-5, the Coliseum, and the hospital expansion, still live with that community today, and it's an important issue for them, and why the conversations about the quote-unquote lid is an important way to demonstrate a way to kind of stitch that community back together.
I'm curious, Paul, when was the impact of all that, is that what drove the opposition to the Mount Rose Freeway? Just all that construction?
Some. I'm going to get to that in a little bit. Okay. But there's some of that was in there, but there was other issues as well. Yeah. Anyway, so I think this project kind of illustrates why we have NEPA. I mean, the pictures that I showed in the discussion we have really, I think, highlight why the various policy things that I went through in my timeline, why those things were happening, because this type of impact to community was happening all over the country. So one of the more fascinating kind of comparisons, if you want to do a before and after and today, is really the 205. So if you were standing where that blue dot is in Clackamas, or where the Milwaukee Expressway comes in, the green line there, the southern portion of 205, was done pre-NEPA. Mm-hmm. And was started in the late 60s and was completed within 3 or 4 years. It got up to where 82nd is, and then it was actually completed a little bit further than that, but really you couldn't use it up to about Foster. And then it sat there because NEPA came along. And the NEPA conversation for that north section of 205 gets right into the Mount Hood Freeway conversation. Changed dramatically, and it took until 1983 then to complete all of 205. Compare and contrast that to that little red line on there, which is the Sunrise Corridor, what it takes us today, kind of a modern day NEPA process to go through to build that. So it was kind of an interesting comparison, pre-NEPA, post-NEPA, modern day study happening all in one area.
Pre-NEPA, in that particular case, pre-NEPA or post-NEPA, was there less impact on those communities? I mean, did they actually do their job, or what? I mean, was there still opposition? I'm just curious.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm going to get to that. So here's 205. Picture that when it opened, won national awards and recognized for its urban setting and the beauty of the highway and the engineering feat of building that roadway to where it is today. And we all of us still enjoy the beauty that section of highway has, was completed, I remember my night dates right, but late 60s, early 70s is when that was completed. And it got up to about Foster. So this is Foster, mm-hmm. and it sat in about this looking configuration for a number of years. And again, you can just imagine the impacts that had just on that slide to the houses, mm-hmm. that were there. I mean, that area where the freeway is was all neighborhoods.
Seems like the lesson learned there is when you go, I guess it would be either south or west of Foster, or at least down in that area, or about where the town center is, that was pretty much all agricultural or land. There wasn't much in the way of houses there. When you got to this part, you're into the same kind of problem going through an urban neighborhood that you had with the Rose Quarter Freeway piece.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
That's why I wanted to do west side.
A lot harder to take out people's houses.
So as we went through NEPA, it was interesting reading back to some of the historical ODOT directions and some of my predecessors' discussions about their opinion about NEPA wasn't very high. They didn't have a very high opinion of value to NEPA. They really wanted to keep doing things the way they've always done things. So didn't really, I think, take it very seriously at the outset. I think part of why it took us a while to kind of get over this. And I'll show you some examples later on. But the process before NEPA was essentially the Transportation Commission approving a resolution, typically a one-page resolution with a map attached as an agenda item on their commission meeting, and that was the approval of the project, versus going through NEPA and all the stuff we go through today. And I'll show you some examples of that coming up. But that's the shift that NEPA had for us in our processes going forward. And the shift was away from the control of a commission choosing where it was and put it in the control in the hands of local governments, especially with Senate Bill 100 passing, put the decision-making much more in control of local government than with the Transportation Commission. So in this case, The plan from about Powell or Foster north was for the Mount Hood Freeway to come off the Markham Bridge, basically follow Powell, hit 205, and then go 205 up to 84 on its current alignment. So the Banfield that is used today as 84 was built pre the Interstate Act, and so we had federal money for the interstate to build section of 84, and they did, the designers didn't want it down in Sullivan's Gulch there. They wanted it an area where they could expand and make it larger and not be confined by the terrain or by the railroad that was in there. And so the plan was to build the Mount Hood Freeway that came off the Markham Bridge and connected to 205 and then followed 205 jointly up to where it is today and then 84 on to the east. So that section of 205 from here north was envisioned to be an 8-lane freeway. Mm-hmm. And that's part of what we got into with NEPA as we were doing NEPA in this section was the county changed their support for that design under NEPA and said, no, we don't want that. What we want is we want a 2-lane design. We want to minimize the amount of interchanges. And we want basically just to focus on through traffic and not have this freeway serve the local community, but just get it through here and have as little impact as possible. The compromise was an interesting compromise. The compromise was to keep the footprint of the right-of-way at that wide range out for an 8-lane freeway, but to only build 2 lanes now, not build the extra interchanges, and also to allow for a future bus rapid transit lane in that area.
Hmm.
So here's how Foster looks after it was built, but interesting enough that lane where the bus rapid transit was dedicated for is where we put light rail today. So we envisioned that. Shortly after the highway opened at that 2 lanes, it was obvious you needed to expand it to 3 lanes, so it was expanded to 3 lanes. Some of the interchanges they left out, such as Johnson Creek Boulevard, was added later on. But that 4th lane is what we're using today as we build the aux lanes in that area. It's the right-of-way for that. The structures were all built long enough. It was all pre-planned to be a 4th lane of freeway is what we're using today for those aux lanes in that area. So it was interesting to me to kind of connect those dots. So that decision that was made, negotiated between the OTC and the county back in the day, and how it affects us today with where light rail is and even those aux lanes we're building as we speak.
Interesting.
So turning to then kind of modern day, so Sunrise Corridor, oh, I forgot to bring one of my props. One of my props was going to be back when I started for ODOT. I worked in the Region 1 office as a designer, and I did the original layout of where the Sunrise Corridor was going to be, including the Milwaukee Expressway all the way on out past Boring to 26. So it's been interesting in my career to kind of follow the path of this project. We finally, just a few years ago, opened a segment of something I worked on 35 years ago to build. But this section was started.
There's a lesson there that it takes an entire career to get a project done.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, the lesson learned was there was no funding for it. So yeah. It was a dream, kind of. It was something that was seen as a need, but there wasn't
no way to fund it.
So we started that work in the late 80s. Did a draft and supplemental document in the early 90s, and then we put it on the shelf because there was no funding. And it wasn't picked back up again until about 08. Yeah, in 08, we picked the document back up again and completed the document. And then in the Jobs and Transportation Act, about $100 million was put towards this project and completed a segment of it. There's another segment that goes out to Rock Creek further to the east, but completed the section. So back to my earlier comments, and make sure you've got kind of a funding stream before you start doing too much on design. You got the scope and the funding kind of figured out hand in hand as you go.
Since you're there, Paul, let me ask a question. Did the what's been completed now, did that perform the way it was envisioned when you designed it? Or is that performing, I guess?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. I think you're actually, if you're a regular commuter on 205, after this open, you've noticed a significant difference on just the less congestion on 205, let alone in the Clackamas area. Hmm. So, yes, I think it has performed the way we anticipated performing. So moving on to another Interesting case study here. So here's 1955. We're building I-5 between Salem and Portland. So this is after the legislative action in 47 for us to build limited access highways, and before the interstate era, we're out building I-5. So here's, I'm gonna talk a little bit about the decision-making process that the commission had back in the day. So here's a photograph of what we call the Minnesota Highway. This is I-5 looking north from downtown. If you look real close where my cursor is right there, that's the interstate bridge over the Columbia, right there next to that I-5 symbol. Mm-hmm. The commission picked Minnesota Avenue as the route, and the decision-making process they went through was a piece of paper like this with that map that's on there, and it was an agenda item on the commission agenda. And, you know, we're off building through the middle of neighborhoods and, you know, building these highways with significant amount of impacts. The commission was had a lot of authority. It was a very powerful commission back in the day to make these kind of decisions. You know, here's a copy of the resolution. This was for the section around Capitol Highway, so just before the Twilliger curves. This was that section, and here's the map that went with it. So those were the two documents on the commission agenda versus NEPA and land use and everything else that we go through today to build that section of highway. So compare that to Newburgh-Dundee. I asked our folks to put together the NEPA documentation we had to build that highway, and they brought it over to me in this box. I went to lift it this morning to bring it over here, and I couldn't lift it. So I took out most of the things that are in here just so I could carry it over here. But it's that versus, you know, this. This is this resolution. So these two pieces of paper here, here's the resolution, and then here's the map for I-5 between Portland and Salem. This is what it took us to build across that prime agricultural land, took us these two documents. Newburgh-Dundee took us, like I said, several kind of decades to get through. You had four jurisdictions that needed to take land use actions to amend their comp plans. It took the largest Goal 3 exception ever taken in the state to build this highway. Mm-hmm. Every one of our highway expansion or new highway projects are considered a goal exception. So back to Senate Bill 100, anytime we go through and build a new highway, we have to go through the goal exception process as well as plan amendments. With this project, there were several LUPA appeals, several lawsuits that were filed as we got through this. And this was in a community in general was supportive of the need of transportation. Now, I wouldn't describe necessarily the four jurisdictions. It took them a while to kind of get aligned around that. Dundee and Newburgh all kind of had a different approach of what they, you know, what they were trying to accomplish. But we were trying to thread this needle of this alignment through high value agricultural land, high impacts to the communities. If you went off the ag land, you were into the communities, and then you had impacts to airports, impact to the mill, impact to neighborhoods. If you stayed away from those, then you're into this prime farmland and the river, and impact to wetlands and other natural features along the river. So it was quite a lengthy process. The length of the process again was driven a lot because of there was no funding identified for the project. Hmm. But once we had some identification or at least some hope of some funding for the project, the process was really able to wrap up.
If the state land use restrictions were not an issue, would NEPA had still pushed that much?
Yes, and I think it actually would have taken longer because you would have had all these disputes would have played out in the federal courts mm-hmm. rather than playing out in LUBA and state courts. And so actually in this case, I would say that the land use laws versus NEPA actually helped the process, and it kept things focused more locally to be resolved and to get to this kind of answer rather than a federal court that could have given you who knows what answer when that would have been. Hmm. So that's just something I don't know if that's true or not, but it's the comment that I heard from our attorneys and others that were working on it. That was their sense of comparing and contrasting the two.
I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah.
Chair Byer.
Yeah, go ahead.
Paul, if you went through the NEPA process, let's say you mentioned something earlier about an 8-lane freeway.
Right.
So let's say you go through the NEPA process for an 8-lane freeway, and it gets down to the funding, and you can only do 4 lanes or 6 lanes. Do you still have the approval of through the NEPA process for expansion later, or do you still have to go back through?
Yeah, so New Burgundy is going to be a great example of that. We've built just a piece of the middle piece of it, and we've only built it to 2 lanes rather than 4 lanes.
Right.
So the NEPA document shows everything on this map. The NEPA document covers all the way from Dayton all the way past Newburgh. The section we just built was basically from Dundee just past, not even past Newburgh, but to Newburgh. So there's still many phases. We'll have to update some of that, but it'll still cover that. Another good example, we built I-5 through Salem. It's taken us 20-some years to finish the different segments, and we're still building the last segment that was in the original environmental document that goes out to where commercial comes in. We're still referring back to the original environmental document that was done, I'm just guessing, about 20 years ago for that segment. So they can have a long shelf life if you stay within the design that you originally had, and you may have to update different features of it, but they can service you well on in the future.
Can you still have legal challenges?
I think you can always have, you can always have legal challenges. I think the other challenges, again, the land use issues don't go away. You still have to have your conditional use permits, even at a tactical level, even if you've got some of your goal exception and comp plan amendments that are done.
Thank you.
Okay. South Medford Interchange was an interesting one for me. As for 20 years, I was the region manager in Southern Oregon. So kind of dealt with this one firsthand. This is the interchange in Medford. If you're familiar with the Medford area, the Rogue Manor retirement facility is right there. Barnett Road is, and I-5 is where the interchange is. This was completed in 1963. Today, this is what the interchange looks like. We actually took the ramps off of Barnett Road here, so it's now it serves as just an overcrossing, and built a new interchange further to the south, and connected it there. The interesting part of this, back to land use, so we had a facility built in 1963. We didn't have money to upgrade it. The community was growing leaps and bounds. Wanted to do upzoning and urban growth boundary expansions, and we were taking them or threatening to take them to LUBA because they weren't fulfilling the needs of the transportation system. They were pointing back to us saying, well, it's your facility, then go fix it. Well, we don't have money. So that was the dilemma that we were in kind of a fairly hostile conversations back and forth for a number of years. And as kind of being the region manager on the front lines of many of those conversations, it was interesting times.
So this is the south one. We also did the north interchange, correct, which is a fairly big project too.
Correct.
Are they connected with that new bypass, the one that we just opened?
The old viaduct and I-5 actually connects them. The new bypass takes off and goes north from the north interchange on Highway 62.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we went there on our tour.
Yeah.
So the solution here was the locals actually came up with $15 million towards an $80 million facility, combining with funding that came from the legislature to build this $80 million new interchange. But as an example, how land use, I don't know, kind of from the back end, can affect your transportation system, as a community grows and wants to do those urban growth boundary expansions and do those upzonings and are limited by an antiquated transportation system.
Good one. So another example of every time we talk about an overpass, it's about $80 million.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, we're
Paul,
just did
dive a little bit deeper in that. Do you think that politically ODOT sees itself as needing to protect the community from growth that doesn't have the transportation planning associated with it, and therefore is going to be likely working out ahead of those land use decisions? Because I think in the metro area, I'm confused by that sentiment. We're seeing all this West Side development, for example, and clearly congestion increasing significantly. But I haven't seen ODOT saying, hold on, we got to have roads before you do this.
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm the best one to get into that, because I'm not as familiar with just how all that works. I'm familiar with this case in that what we were seeing from a very practical standpoint is we were seeing growth happening so fast, that interchange being so congested, it was backing out onto the freeway for a half a mile at times during the commute. And so we were seeing a safety operational issue that we were raising our hand saying, this is not working. And they wanted to do, you know, more growth and more zone changes.
I would make the same argument, though, about 99 and Sunset Elwood today and a new high school going in, and yet we haven't done anything to deal with those traffic issues there. So
yeah, I know enough to be dangerous on that, so I'd rather not kind of venture into that. That's probably more of our Region 1 staff and more currently where we are with some of those land use issues can get you some better answers.
I'm just curious about the feeling of ODOT today maybe versus yesterday in terms of its role in those conversations.
Yeah, I think one thing that has changed significantly. Back in the day of this, South Medford, we were very much about keeping the freeway and the system in general working at, let's say, a level of service A, that we had to have free flow. And if you didn't have the... So today, our conversations, our planning, our policies are more tolerant or more expectant of congestion happening on our roadways, where in this day when we did this project, that wasn't true. And it, actually, this was one of the first projects we went through and temporarily lowered our standards to allow for more congestion so they could grow while we were building the interchange. It was the first time we did that.
And that trend has kind of continued.
Yes.
Our
policies have recognized that we're not going to be able to keep all our freeways working at a level service A or all our roadways at that level. It's a volume capacity ratio that we talk about. But
thanks.
Let's move on.
Okay, last one. Bend Parkway, I thought this was interesting, just in more of a modern day example. Mm-hmm. So the Bend Parkway was opened in 2001. It's about a 7 mile new roadway. Cost us about $114 million. The environmental document was 175 pages. So here's New Burgundy, and this one was about 175 pages. The document itself cost about $1 million to do the document. As we look north today, we're been through the NEPA process on the Bend North Corridor. House Bill 2017 put $50 million towards an improvement in this segment. This is a 1.5 mile versus a 7 mile segment. Our estimated cost is $175 million for that versus $114. The document cost $5.5 million and was 2,240 pages rather than 175 pages. So just in the same NEPA, same laws, but just as we have developed case law, as we've had different lawsuits and understand more and more the documentation that we've got to go through to document our decisions, shows just a continual growth in the amount of work that we have to do in the upfront to make sure we meet those NEPA requirements. I thought I'd close with just a couple of fun photos that I found, or not very fun, but interesting photographs that I found going through that I didn't really find a good place in the presentation to put them. This is a photograph or a design conception of what the Mount Hood Freeway in 205 was supposed to look like. So here's Powell Boulevard is going down this way. Division is up here. And this was that 8-lane freeway and interchange that I was talking about. This was one of the renditions of what that massive interchange was supposed to look like. It's hard to imagine that there today. And then we had just all over the state we had these as we were building new highways. So here's, this is one in Lincoln City where we were going through and looking for different design alternatives to deal with the congestion. This was probably in the mid-60s. I don't have an exact date on this, but somewhere probably in the mid-60s. Different alternatives to go around through and bypassed Lincoln City. So back before NEPA, back before Senate Bill 100. There's most of the alignments on here, there's no way you would build any of these alignments today. You would not get through the NEPA process. You would not get through the process it would take to build those. But we were, as designers, we were very, you know, proactive in having plans and thinking about these mega projects and what we were going to solve from a transportation standpoint, not what we were going to create the problems of, you know, devastating neighborhoods or other environmental impacts we were going to have, but we were solving transportation problems. Anyway, I thought those were kind of interesting, just tidbits to
I have to express, Mr. Chair, I am absolutely dumbfounded and so depressed that you didn't include the West Side Bypass in your conversation at all. That's why I came today, Paul. So,
well, you didn't. I mean, we have similar lessons learned in where I live, in the Eugene area.
Yeah.
We ODOT went through the process, well, three times actually. Yeah. Once to build one in the early 70s and bought all the right of way, and then the city passed a charter amendment saying you couldn't do it. And then he started over again to build a different one, bypass, where wetlands got involved more.
Right.
Wetlands. And then the city decided they didn't want that one either after all the land was bought.
The design was done. I could have picked. I mean, whether it was the Seaside bypass, or whether it was the West Eugene conversation, there's a number of mounted freeways, a classic one, but there's a number of examples.
But I would point on that because I'm familiar with it. Yeah. I think the lesson learned on that one is because we didn't build one of those others, we're now stuck with what's called the Beltway, major design challenge on that, no money to build it, and it's very dangerous where it is, trying to put a Band-Aid on that to make that work, which is going to be very difficult. And it'll probably end up costing in the neighborhood of $300 million to fix it all.
Yeah. Can I make your...
No, go ahead.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
The way I feel about your presentation was I came here looking for hope.
Yeah.
And I want lessons learned, but I want some hope, too. And so what your presentation did for me is to really make sure that we are understanding where we are. You know, I mean... We can see where we've been. We can see where we had, you know, different conditions. We know where we are today and what we have to deal with. And there's other lessons, too. There's very much, in my mind, and we can agree to be on both sides of this, right, that somewhere between where Rich is and where I am, I think, on something like the West Side Bypass is a middle ground of the balance. You know, you didn't talk about balance. You just talked about major highway, you know, expansions. Right. You talked about the light rail once.
Right.
Okay, and so we've got light rail, and we've got some of these other issues that are in the new mix that we have to deal with, too. But two things that you said that gave me hope, and that is that, number one, we've learned lessons about when you put money to a project. And we also, I think, have learned lessons to specifically how we've got to look at both budget and design, you know, considerations together.
Yep.
And that we've got to be careful when and how the NEPA process works.
Correct.
Now, all of those are things that we can massage.
The one I would add to that list is that recognizing local governments are in control of the land use process, mm-hmm. and making sure as you're doing that scope and working through the issue, that you're working through the land use issues, that they're going to have decision-making authority over.
So let me add one thing to that, and then I'll be quiet.
Yeah.
Up in our area, we've got the Metropolitan Portland, you know, JPEC process, but we also have to deal with the processes in Banks and North Plains and all the other small cities out and around our boundary. And that also, even the Newburgh bypass, you know, whatever we're calling that, you know, that all of that, we had those kinds of considerations too, but in the reverse land use consideration, where all of those came first.
Right.
And so again, it's not just a simple overlay of land use, it's a combination of which land use decisions you're talking about.
Right.
And I guess, and I'll get you, the sort of the observation seems to be one of the issues is we seem to have done a better job in the 50s and 60s of trying to look ahead in more of a strategic way that we seem to not be doing as well now.
And I think the reason for that is the control the local governments have in their comp plans and in shaping their transportation. You don't have that same, at a project level, that same authority at a state level. We have a policy level that the commission has in setting policies with the Oregon Transportation Plan, the highway plan, and so forth. But from a project standpoint, those decisions are so influenced by local government's decision in their transportation comp plans. I shouldn't say it's impossible, but it's difficult for to have a statewide plan like we did in the interstate era of laying out the interstates everywhere and thinking you're going to have to go through every county and most every city's comp plan to adjust those to, you know, what that thing is. So I think there's at a project level, it's very difficult to have that planning, that vision at a state level.
Here's the piece that I'm troubled by, and I can't figure it out. The land use process is a creature of the legislature. Mm-hmm. We created that in Senate Bill 100, and in normal legislative parlance, we can deal with it in two ways. We can change the statute, or we can use that ever popular word notwithstanding. But I'm torn between listening to you saying, okay, so we could create and say, creating a good transportation system, highway system, is a paramount requirement and should rest with the legislature. The other side of that are a creature of the Transportation Commission. The other side of that one is I thought I heard you say having that process, the land use process, saves us from landing in federal court. And is there I'm not speaking very well. Is there a lesson learned here that the legislature ought to be considering? Is there a middle ground to deal with that? Mm-hmm. And the other piece is, you know, I think part of that vision is trading off in terms of we have other land use things in terms of trying to encourage compact urban growth alternatives and thinking through that process a little better. I mean, we can do all of that, but we still have to move freight.
Right. Can I make an observation in that regard, Mr. Chair? The whole reason I ran for the legislature in the first place was West Side Metro transportation issues. That's why I wanted to come down here. What I quickly kind of began to feel was maybe Salem, ODOT, the legislature, wasn't the solution. Maybe that wasn't the place to do it. The best example is how Denver finally got their east ring, the E-470. They did it by legislatively creating a process whereby the local jurisdictions could get together. And that E-470 was built with no state. I mean, Colorado Department of Transportation had oversight for some of the design features, et cetera. But it was all those counties and cities along the route that got together, got their own communities to say, yes, we're okay with the way this is going to look, and we want this to happen. And it was the E-470 Commission that built that road with no public money as a toll road, based on these communities getting together. I've been looking for years, frustrated with, and sometimes vocally frustrated with ODOT for not being leaders in this, for not stepping up. But what I'm realizing is that may not have been the right place to complain, because if you didn't have any money and you didn't have any way to see forward on this, what could you do? So I guess what I'm saying is I'm kind of hopeful that this will encourage my colleagues in the legislature to continue the conversation about whether doing things like we just did in Washington County, where we amended the transportation system plan to say we're going to now study major arterials and look at the need to go back to doing some of those kinds of things. The county, Hillsborough, all getting together and doing those things, if we can give them the freedom and the facilitation to do that, I think that may be a way for us to get out of this conundrum.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
Okay, so I have a question about, okay, so historically, ODOT designed and drove the projects that happened in the 50s and 60s, and there was federal funding out there and it was available. As of today, in Oregon, we don't have projects moving forward, and the projects that we do have moving forward get held up because of the design may be put out, but there's no funding behind them. So my question would be, is there a way, or is, I mean, it seems like it's wrong. Like the roles right now are reversed. ODOT is the one that brings forward the plan, but there's no actual funding. Like there's no collaboration, meaning that, does that make sense what I'm saying? And maybe it touches a little bit on what Representative Vile is saying, is that maybe it should be some other driving force besides ODOT. And then the other question I had was on ODOT right now, when they come up with these kind of plans, if they come up with these kind of plans today, is that state funded? Is that federal funded? Like, how does that work for you guys to sit down and design and come up with ideas?
Yeah, so it's the funding isn't any funding we can come up with. We'll apply for federal grants. We'll come to the legislature and ask for, you know, funding packages or funding increases. Our commission is prioritizing funding that we do have. Maybe an example of a plan at a project level we have today is all of the auxiliary lanes that we've been building in Portland. We had a plan for that 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little longer than that identified all the needs between the interchanges, where if we just built one more lane between this off-ramp and, or this on-ramp and this off-ramp, it was going to change things. And we had 15 or 20 of those around the metro area that we wanted to build. We just opened probably one of the more significant ones that connects 205 south, 217 southbound to
right.
205.
Yep.
It's had a huge impact in the amount of congestion.
You see that area.
Major.
So we have identified, I don't know, like 20 of those around the metro area that we wanted to build. So we had a plan at a project level. We had a plan.
Okay.
And we worked with Metro to get that into the comp plan or transportation plan of the area. And then look to fund it. And so we've come to legislature funding. We've used federal funds however we can to get those funded. So that's probably the best example I can think of a project-level plan we had at ODOT that we wanted to implement to make the system better.
Okay, that's it. That's
The reality is you and I are both lame ducks right now, so we can maybe just have this conversation in a little bit different context. If you look at the Long Beach tollway system and the San Joaquin tollway system, both done with essentially private highway authorities overseen by California's system, and E-470 as at least west examples, and there's lots of examples out east, do you think, Paul, that's what we ought to try and legislatively enable so that we can get, because auxiliary lanes are great, but unless we have some new facility planning, those are only going to be the Band-Aid or the temporary solution. So what do you think about the San Joaquin, Orange County, E-470 kind of models?
I guess I have a hard time. I don't know that much about the politics of how those went. I understand maybe the mechanics of them, but the politics of how you get something like that through the process I'm describing with the various land use decisions and the NEPA decisions you have to go through. I think for us, the first step is the tolling step we're taking today and making sure we understand tolling and how we can manage our system through tolls. I think will start to tell us a lot more information about our system and where we do need to expand it, whether it's more lanes on that existing facilities or new facilities or transit or, you know, light rail or whatever. I think we'll start to understand more of those trade-offs and dynamics as we put pricing into the congestion question, and you start to price that, will start to inform driver behaviors and where you may need. And it'll also potentially give you a funding source to start to do that, as well as the back room and the mechanics. specifics of how you would go about, you know, funding some of these major projects. Because I think, as you're pointing out, as you look around the country, how people are funding these projects today are almost all through tolls. I can't even think of one off the top of my head that wasn't done through some kind of tolling. Mm-hmm. So for us to take that step first in tolling, I think is going to be a critical step, and for us to start to learn then about how we can apply that in the Oregon environment.
I suspect, though, that the planning and the decision to move forward of those was a public process, and the tolling and selecting of a contract to do that was more than implementation. Might have been the design and building instance, but I would bet that you had a public process, and I think you described it in the Denver area, first where the collectively the public, you know, through the representatives, decided what they wanted, and then they put it up to someone else to do it.
In Denver, for example, it started out with one county and one city, and they adopted this legislative enablement that let them form their own district. It was a special district, basically. Hmm. Now they tend to call those authorities rather than districts, but it's the same concept. That county and that city then started to get neighbors to say, come on, and every city or county had to adopt a resolution by its leadership to join. But as they joined, it only took about 2.5 years, gradually everybody kind of got this vision, and the roughly 47-mile E-470 link was born out of this local collaboration.
But that's process. At what point did they bring in the tolling authority?
And you're right. It wasn't until they all kind of said, we're going to do this. How are we going to pay for it? And then it was an Austrian company in that particular case.
At least twice, I remember, on the Newburgh Bypass and then the Sunrise Corridor, the legislature, when I was first in, authorized tolling on the Newburgh Bypass. And I remember the county commissioners came in and said, if you do this, we're going to do this. And they went out, and they had the authority, they went out and brought in a tolling expert company and said, nope, can't do it.
Can't afford it.
And the second one, we brought in one of the two big ones, the Australian company, who came in and said, can't do it unless you toll 99 and 205 and all those others, or it won't work.
And I think Paul's observation that tolling experience will inform the investment dialogue around whether people can afford to do it.
Part of that, and I think we're going to learn it with the current experiment with value pricing or whatever we end up calling it. I think you're going to find, and I thought we found this when we were looking at the I-5 bridge, that the tolling by itself was not enough to do it. But it's not, you still have to come up with a matching funding on it and a decision that you're going to do the project, and that's just a piece of it.
It depends on the numbers, and it obviously depends on where that kind of point is versus how much you charge and how much it, you know, affects the volumes for the bridge project. That was true for projects. If you're just looking to add a lane or doing a more modest project, the tolling potentially could cover the entire cost. So it depends on the project that you're envisioning.
Yeah, but then you run into some rules of what the feds will allow you to do with that funding source. Susan?
Well, as I'm listening to everybody also, I'm thinking about the filter of technology and automation. Because, we're in a different spot. We have different things coming, and we have different potential. And just like the potential that you're talking about as far as funding and tolling, adding new tools, I think the same situation has to do with what that system looks like, whether it's smart interchanges or, you know, whether we're dealing with a different variety of freight vehicles, you know, on our system or whatever else. We've got to be realistic about where we are and where we're, you know, where it looks like technology may take us.
And the impact. I mean, the whole idea of value pricing is to change where people drive and whether they drive or not, or whether they use an alternative and get out of the way of the truck. Mm-hmm. And that's part of it. I wanted, did I cut you off?
I'm fine.
Paul, I know you didn't plan to do this, but because we're being thrown back into a discussion on the I-5 bridge again, that one, there was a lot of criticism about not at the end, not adequate public input and the whole scoping question. But my memory, and I want to check with you, is that process actually started in, what, 97 or 98, and it had a bi-state legislative involvement that created a bi-state local government and citizen committee that spun around wheels for a long time. And then we got to the end, and finally, governor pushed the final design, governors, I should say, although mostly driven by Kitzhaber, to deal with that one. And it's sort of that whole, how do we get to that scoping? It's sort of what the point you were making early on. So, you know, we get a community agreement, if you will, about this. Yes, we need to build something, and yes, this is sort of what it's like. Now go forth and scope it. This is how much money we can afford to put into it.
Yeah, I think you just described the process. I guess my learning from that would be, is there an opportunity for leadership, governor, legislature leadership at the outset, as you start that process, to form some expectations and some, you know, parameters, either financially or scope, to help facilitate and drive the decision to a decision-making process to a decision. As I look back on a lot of our projects, they start out at kind of a grassroots level, and they seem to kind of spin around a lot trying to figure out what is that direction, what is our financial, and then later in the process, like you described with the bridge, then you get leadership and so forth coming in later in the process to kind of drive things to across the finish line. I think if you could have a little bit of interaction at the outset to help shape that project earlier, would streamline and move the process forward.
I wasn't, not living in Portland, I wasn't as clear. You guys know better than that on that. But I know in my end of the valley, it seems like a lot of the problem is there's an agreement up front, but then it takes so long that there's changes in political leadership, and you get a new group of people who don't agree with the decision that was made.
I've seen that on a project in Vandy where the commission put a project in place. We went there to build it. The committee was so upset, they recalled the entire city council and put a new one in. So it can actually drive the leadership based on where the direction of the project's going. So you got to be careful, you don't push too hard. You don't have to find out things that happen as well.
And sometimes you came up with this. I'm thinking of the Beltline interchange, I-5 interchange in Eugene, the original design that ODOT came up with, I thought was much better than the one that the community ended up with, which they don't particularly like now.
Chair Barr.
Yes.
Paul, this is probably an unfair question, so I'll just say it up front. How much validity and value do you believe the prior work on the Big River Crossing, I don't know what we're supposed to call it anymore.
Mm-hmm. The bridge that wasn't.
The bridge to nowhere.
The bridge to somewhere. But there was a lot of work done. I came from Southern Oregon many, many times to testify because we have people down there who were impacted by the congestion and the gridlock of the bridge and now of the entire Portland Metro freeway system. So there's got to be some validity to the work that's been done.
Yeah, there's value there. It depends on how much you stray away from the design that was studied under the NEPA process. We went out and actually did borings for the footing, so all the geology hasn't changed. So all that information we gathered to build the structure, as long as you're going to put the footings in that same place, you may change the design of the bridge, may change that, but the geology underneath where the footings are going to go hasn't changed. So there's elements of what we had that'll be valid today as they were back then.
To that point, because I think all of us are thinking ahead to this meeting we have next Wednesday or whenever it is on the bridge, but we're trying to figure out, I think, in our mind, how do we get the most out of what we've already done? And then also on, again, the lessons learned, what are the processes of making commitments that are done on a regular basis throughout the process and not just a big one at the end where one of the legislators or legislation doesn't pass. you know, it does, we don't get the budget. And so, you know, how do we keep that commitment going with, you know, we're agreeing to this, we're agreeing to this all the way along, because that helps us a little bit with the change of faces in some of the seats. But we've got to do something. We all know we've got to do something. And it's one of those things where a lot of the things that you said today, again, I've got my list of lessons learned and new filters. And so I'm just trying to figure out how do we keep the commitment in place? How do we keep going to the next step? How do we use as much as we can from last time and still commit to listening to the direction of some of the leaders that are going to be needed to make this happen?
Part of that one and that lesson, I think there's lots of discussions, but I think a major obstacle was a political difference between the two states. Yeah. It's actually the legislators on the southern side, and on our side some too, is from the Oregon perspective, and that one, you weren't going to get approval to build a bridge without putting light rail on it.
Right.
And on the Washington side, they weren't going to approve a bridge that had light rail on it.
Yeah.
And those are just, we probably collectively should have decided that very early on, and we could have not spent a whole lot of money spinning around. That was that. And then I think the environmental issues came in of the design of how high did, once you decided that you couldn't build a bridge, a lift bridge, you started getting into the height restrictions and problems with airports and all of that. There were technical issues around that.
From a public perception as well, I think moving forward, transportation in general is going to have a very hard time getting the general public behind anything, because we spent $180 million already on something that didn't happen, that was thrown out. And so it's going to be hard as far as a trust factor. Mm-hmm. Whether you live in Portland or you live in Salem or you live in Medford, we spent $180 million on something that did nothing for us. So that's a little bit... I think that'll be a barrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it's an interesting one, because when we did the transportation bill and went around, the one thing that we heard consistently from the business community throughout the state was, you got to fix congestion in Portland and fix the bridge. And come on.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Oregon did, Washington didn't.
Right.
And now Washington wants to. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, so...
Not to back up, but on the Newburgh-Dundee project, how much of that was state versus federal?
The funding for construction was predominantly state. It was probably about that 90-10.
Okay.
Not quite that, but it was predominantly state funded.
I guess, Paul, the one thing that could change, and we'll see, I was talking with Congressman DeFazio, a lot of the projects that we did in the past were what they called earmarks. And there seems to be, at least he believes, that his colleagues on both sides of the political aisle would like to go back to that, because they've decided that turning the decision-making over to the bureaucrats wasn't a good thing the end of the day.
But even if you do that, more fundamentally, there's just not money at the first level. So you're going to take it away from the formula money for pavements or bridges and move it out to earmark. There's not... a sustainable funding model at the federal level is what they've got to fix that before
this is more political than procedural. There's not the political will to raise a bunch of money and give it to an agency to decide how to spend it.
Yeah.
Which could change if, frankly, like we did a little bit in 2017, we showed the people where the money was going to be spent, showed the members. You're seeing that at the local level. There's been, in my community, just passed a transportation bond. Eugene's on their third one. Many communities are doing that. But what the lesson we've learned is, if the leadership, whether local or statewide, puts a project out and says, this is what we're going to try to raise and this is where we're going to spend it, that the public say, okay, we'll buy that.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah, totally.
Senator, Paul. What problems do you see with the idea of enabling local jurisdictions to create special districts or special authorities that would operate independent of ODOT on major projects, a limited access highway kind of.
So tolling authorities?
Well, yeah, maybe it, well, I'm talking more about the E-470 kind of model where the legislature created this special district concept.
Yeah.
And said, now you have the authority, and that authority included authority to do condemnation if necessary. It included authority to all the things that you would need.
I think you have, I actually think you have that under RS 190.
Only for certain specific
it's pretty broad.
Recognized authorities like Metro as the PSA for that area. That's my understanding. That's why I ran 3431 in 2017.
I don't know, but I don't. There are lots of special districts out there, and that statute. Well, I said 190. They're not all formed under 190. There's the other special district statute. The question is probably not the ability to form that. It's how do you authorize the revenue raising piece of it.
And that's where...
And the intertie with federal money.
Yeah, yeah. The 3431 model, the E-470 model essentially, does say that once local jurisdictions have created this special district or this authority, that then they have the ability to conduct voting within their jurisdictions to do the money-raising part as well. And maybe I'm wrong, Senator. I couldn't find that specific authority anywhere in statute. That's why we ran that. And the cities that, like Hillsborough and Washington County had that same concern.
I mean, that's a good question. Patrick, could we ask you to talk with Legislative Council and explore that question?
And the question has to include...
Does the authority include there, and if not, what would it take to create that?
And it also has to look at the structure that we have, the regional government in place with a, you know, with a piece, too.
Yeah.
Well, but Susan, that is the conundrum right now, because the likelihood of where a West Metro solution might end up being designed is outside of the Metropolitan Services boundary.
I get that.
And so you've got this sort of jurisdictional concern that hasn't been resolved yet.
I think this, what you're saying, leads us to kind of a really important thing, and why we're here is the E-40 you keep speaking of is an example of a successful project. Mm-hmm. So if we had a way to get information on how that project was successful from the planning and even how they selected it, and we can compare that to a project we know like the bridge that was not successful, and we can compare and contrast those to move forward and be able to select projects using like a successful model. So we need to develop a model, right?
That's interesting because that one and some of the others have happened during the era where you had to do the EPA stuff.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Figure out how they did that.
If we can find successful models that are recent, that would really be beneficial.
Patrick, I've got a whole office full of stuff on E-470 up there, so please.
Okay.
I was going to have a yard sale anyway, soon, so please come get it.
Well, I think we pretty much covered the agenda that you were going to do. Anything additional for Paul? Paul, thank you very much for doing the research.
It was
very enlightening, and it focused a lot of attention. It also left us with a lot of questions.
I'm still disappointed you didn't do West Side Bypass, but that's all right. We'll do that another time.
All righty. Anything else for the good of the order? Patrick?
Mr. Chair, I don't think we have another meeting scheduled. We're in a little bit of a limbo, Mr. Chair, in that technically this task force ceases to exist December 31st, but it's my understanding that it's this group's desire plus leadership's desire for it to continue next session, since it got it such a late start. So we just might have to wait and see.
So I will take on talking to the Senate President's office. Will you talk with the Speaker?
Yeah.
Come on. Just express it. I think the desire was it needs to go forward.
And I believe that leadership
still willingness to serve.
They plan to have that happen. Okay. We just need to dot the I's and stuff to make that happen. Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
All righty, if we have nothing else, we